Hi, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, July 27th, the year 2002, and Harold and Mai Vogelaar are doing a session in their series, Meeting and Greeting Our Muslim Neighbors. This is session number 5. It's entitled, The Threat of Islam, Myth or Reality. So now let's go to the fireside room for this session. And this is tape number VOH-2002-05. Now let's listen in.
Just a reminder that the tape starts, and it's very sensitive, so whatever is said sort of gets recorded, so you may want to always keep that in mind. Well, I'm Harold Vogelaar, and here with my wife, Itzamai. And this session is the last of 5. It'll be on from headlines into heartlines, looking at contemporary Islam. We began our sessions. Those of you who are there, any who were here before from the very beginning? Just one? Okay.
Two,
okay. All right, we'll recycle this. This will be recycled stuff next week. They asked us to recycle it. But I remember the first session, we actually looked at the story of Abraham, Ishmael, and Isaac, and Abraham as the archetype of faith for Muslims, how they see their faith rooted in the faith of Abraham. That's a very interesting story. And then we looked at the life of Muhammad, and there's a good video on that. And then we talked about Muslims recognize the prophethood of Jesus. What would be a proper response of Christians to Muhammad? And then, in part, we need to know more about Muhammad before we can even make an honest statement on that. Much has been said, of course, in the past, and much of it has been very, very negative. Then we looked at the faith and practice of Islam, and Mai spoke about the 6 articles of faith and the 5 pillars, and then she demonstrated the prayer, etc. And then we talked about the expansion of Islam, the great empires of Islam, and we have a video. We looked at some of that. Islam, empire of faith. And for many in the Christian world, particularly in America, this is kind of a blank period. We don't know much of what happened in the Middle East. For many, we don't know much, say, between the New Testament and Martin Luther, maybe. And then we find out about the Roman Catholic Church, but in a sort of negative way. But there's often that kind of blank area there. And actually, it was during that period, from 700, say, through the 16th century, well, all the way into the 20th century with the Turkish Empire, the Ottoman Empire, these great empires of the Umayyads, the Abbasids, the Fatimids, going all the way from India, the Mughals in India, all the way to the Umayyads in Spain for several hundred years there. We looked at that a bit. Now we want to look at this sort of top period here, beginning perhaps with the era of colonialism. And we said that there were back and forth. There was the crusade, the conquest, and then the crusades, and back and forth historically. We've sort of been at odds with each other. Some would call that the clash of civilizations. We looked at some of these clashes. By the end of the 17th century, 1600s or thereabouts, The great empires of Islam had begun to implode upon themselves. Even the Ottoman Empire was beginning to have problems internally. And the West then took a lot of the knowledge that the Muslims had preserved, and that began the whole Renaissance here, out of the Middle Ages, the Renaissance, and then the Great Age of Western expansion. Many of us study that in schools. And out of that, of course, came empire building, the dominance of the West, the whole colonial stream. If you look at this map, this is a map of the Muslim world. As you can see, because Muslims made the map, the heart of Islam is right in the center, right? When we do maps in our country, the United States is right in the center. Well, this tells you a little bit about the Muslim world, and it goes all the way from Indonesia and into China here, the southern tier of what was the former Soviet Union, and then Pakistan. Of course, India has a large number of Muslims, Bangladesh, and this whole green area there. About 80% of that, during the colonial period, came under Western Christian domination. And we were there with guns and artillery, with gunboat diplomacy, etc. And that whole period for the Muslim world, I kind of liken to the exile of the ancient Hebrews. Only this time they weren't sent out to another place like the ancient Hebrews, some of them anyway, but they were exiled in their own home. And the forces, the powers that be, were all Western, quote, Christian. And it was a time of deep humiliation, great angst. And when you begin to read their literature, it's very much like the lament of the Psalms. What has happened? Oh, how the mighty have fallen. How is it that we, who were so mighty, had such great empire, that everybody came to us, and we were the center of the universe, as it were, spreading knowledge and enlightenment to everyone else? How is it that we have fallen to such a low estate, and in a sense have become the laughingstock of the world? It almost reminds you of some of the Psalms, doesn't it? The lamenting Psalms. The question was, have we abandoned God? Has God abandoned us? Has God forsaken us because of our evil practices, because of things we did we shouldn't have done, or things we left undone that we should have done? And so there's this wandering of heart and mind, a time of great anguish, pain. Also a time of memory. This past week we talked a lot about memory, you see. It wasn't as though the colonialists came into an area that had no civilization, that had no historic greatness, like it was into a vacuum. Not at all. They had this wonderful memory of what was, this great history that they could claim, and which now sort of lay in ruins. It was during this time that the First World War occurred, and much of the Arab world, anyway, was carved up. And when you look at a map, you remember at the Versailles Conference, and then Churchill and Kitchener and others meeting in Cairo, they literally carved up the Middle East. They made the boundaries between Kuwait and Iraq, and then Jordan came along, Syria, Lebanon, etc. These were boundaries that were sort of imposed. And the Ottoman Empire collapsed. So here you have this this great overarching structure of the Ottoman Empire, and suddenly that was all gone. In that empire, regardless of what you might have thought of the Turks, and the Arabs didn't have any love for the Turks, but everybody had a place, and they all knew their place. There was stability, there was structure, there was sort of order. And then all of that collapsed, and nationalism sort of came to the foreground. Nationalism, which really had no roots in Islam. It's a Western import. It's not endemic, or it's not sort of indigenous to the Islamic way of thinking. Yeah.
To reveal obvious ignorance about, Middle East history, those borders, Syria, Iraq, Jordan, etc., were fluid or non-existent?
They were non-existent. The greater Syria used to include all of Syria, a lot of Transjordan, Palestine, Lebanon. That was known as Greater Jordan. Greater Syria, sorry. Egypt, of course, had a long history of its own identity, so Egypt was a little bit different. But the Arabian Peninsula as well was
basically. Is Iraq a modern construct?
Iraq is a modern construct, right. I mean, the civilization that was there goes way back, right? Historically, way, way back. But Iraq, as it were, the contemporary Iraq, yeah, is a modern construct. And when you look at that, I wish I had a larger map. Here's this rather huge Iraq, and when it comes to the Arabian Gulf, those of us who live there call it the Arabian Gulf, not the Persian Gulf, okay? We live on the Arab side, sorry. Iraq only got just a little space, did you notice? And Kuwait is carved right out there with quite a bit of space on the Arabian Gulf. And you have to ask yourself, why?
Oil.
No, it was oil, but remember, those of you who have some sense of history, the Baghdad, Berlin-Baghdad Railroad, right? The Germans were thinking of putting a railroad all the way from Berlin all the way into Baghdad. Well, when the Brits heard that, they said, all right, but we'll stop them at the end of that. And so they then sort of got the Sabah family, began to support them, carve out a little kingdom right there. And, of course, it all had to do with European politics as it began to impose itself on that area.
Well, just a question about the colonial era when there was all this Western Christian overlay.
Mm-hmm.
But the Ottoman Empire before it was almost the same thing, wasn't it? Except it was sort of Muslim-based?
It was Muslim-based, right.
The
Ottomans...
It was still almost an occupation or a...
You could say that some of the Arabs felt that way. They did. And that's why when the First World War came along, the Brits could get the Arabs, Hussein and Mecca, to make a deal, the McMahon and Hussein agreement, to fight with the British against the Turks, right? So that was one set of agreements that was made by the Brits. Well, at the same time, in 1917, they had the Balfour Declaration, in which they promised the Jews a homeland in Palestine. So here you had two promises that were at odds with each other, and neither knew of the other until later. Yeah.
Wasn't Sykes-Picot agreement even before that?
You had the Sykes-Picot agreement, right? The Brits wanted the Arabs to side with them against the Turks and, of course, against Germany. And the Germans were very strong in North Africa, you remember. And they were afraid the Germans might come in and move into Egypt, and that the Egyptians would side with the Germans against the Brits. Okay? So you had this huge battle of the Sinai, the biggest tank battle, I guess, up until that time, the biggest tank battle in history. The Brits trying to stave off the Germans and to keep the Arabs on their side. Now, you can understand, in a sense, why the Egyptians might think of siding with the Germans, not because they knew much about Germany or the Third Reich or that sort of thing, but they knew the Brits, who were there as conquerors, okay, and who were there with the troops. So to be against them might be a good thing. So all of those tensions were being played out. A lot of history goes on there. And when you live in that area, it's still very much in the minds of people, much like our Civil War, the First World War, the Second, for us, is very vivid in our minds and in our thinking, but always from a Western perspective. We always view things, and why wouldn't we? I mean, we live in the West. But there's another whole perspective as well. When you live in that part of the world, you need to take that into consideration. When they finally ended colonialism, and it's so nice to have an older audience, at least some who are in the audience who are a little older, because they remember the great war in Algeria when the French were there. And that what ended in the early 60s, right? I mean, it wasn't until, you know, in the early 1960s that finally Algeria gained its independence from France. So we're not talking so long ago. Sometimes when you talk to high school students, it sounds like ancient history. Now, no, it wasn't so long. Well, when you come out of this, you get, I put here what I could say, let's see, the left and the conservative, okay, something like that. In other words, you get some, like Ataturk, already after the First World War, decided to opt for secularism. Now, secularism in the Muslim world is an import from the West. It really has no rootage, no philosophical underpinning within the Islamic tradition. So it's strictly a Western phenomenon now being adopted by, say, a Turkey. And they secularized, and as some of you may remember, Ataturk was very powerful in this. Clergy could no longer wear their fezes. Christians could no longer wear their mitres, and, you know, anything. So, and the language became much more secular, Turkish rather than Arabic. So it was really a very strong desire to adopt a Western sort of philosophy. I think we need to always remember that secularism in the West, at least, is homegrown. It grew out of...
What do you mean by secularism?
What do I mean by secularism? Well, I guess it's... If you take secularity and secularism, when you ismize it, then it becomes kind of an ideology, a philosophy, where the main players are probably the human being, where the guiding hand on society are by man-made laws and rules, where God plays a part, but probably not a very important part in the process. So it's a whole sort of way of looking at life. I'm not talking about secularity now, because I think secularity probably, at least I would want to make that a distinction there, where the clerics and the lay people, the clerics lose a lot of their power, the lay people come in, and there's this kind of separation of church and state, which we are so fond of in our society. I keep telling my Muslim friends, it's not a separation of religion and politics. Please, don't mistake that. It's a separation of church and state, the institutions we want to keep separate. That sort of thing. Is that all right? Is that you want more of a definition of that, right? Okay. That for us anyway, it's kind of homegrown, so we can't blame anybody else for it. We can't say these damned Arabs brought it to us, you see, or the Chinese or somebody. This is homegrown stuff. And we have to own it. And we have a philosophy sort of behind it. And therefore it kind of legitimizes it. In the Muslim world, that wasn't true. This was always something imported from outside. And that's still a problem, I think. It still grates on the soul. Yeah, Maya?
Yeah, I would like to focus about the Turkeys, the patterns, the curriculum in the school. They were not mentioned about religions as another Muslim country like Shahada or the main rule in Islam. But they focus on science. Now all the students have to learn about science, and they send their students to have a contest in the science world religions instead of focus on practicing Islam. And they have no classes on Islam in the school, in the curriculum. They try to teach as moral teachings or ethics in the school. That's kind of a secular.
What this was doing, in a sense, in a way, is to mirror the West, okay? To mirror those who had conquered and who seem to be superior at the moment. And so to mirror them, you then imported what they had, hopefully to adapt it to your own self. Usually this began with the military. You trained your people in the West. You got their implements of war. You got all their war knowledge, because that was something that the people in power could use. And so it usually started in the military, but then it spread to other areas as well. On this side, you could put Turkey, and you can put Egypt, and then under Nasser, you even sort of imported socialism. He wasn't the only one, but that became an import. And then you have Iraq on this side as well. There were those who sort of wanted to look to the West and tip their hat to this tradition, but not to take this tradition too seriously. Many of them felt it served them well back here, but somehow in the modern world, what this tradition had to offer really didn't cut muster in the 20th century. So they began to look to the West. And the codes, the Napoleonic codes, Swiss codes, and so were all sort of imported. The Islamic law faded from the picture, except in personal status issues. So the whole structure that was there in the past, a lot of that collapsed. On the right side, you have what many scholars today call the modernists or the reformists. Muhammad Abdu is one of those great figures. He died in 1905 already. And they thought that reform should come through education and internal transformation. They didn't talk about reform. It's hard to talk about reforming Islam, because Islam is that perfect religion. And the Quran said it was completed. It's perfect. So how do you reform that which is perfect? Okay. So they talk about transformation, internal transformation. Abdu, for example, went to France and to England, and when he came back, he wrote these very interesting words. In Europe, I saw Islam, but I didn't see any Muslims. In Egypt, I see many Muslims, but no Islam. So the idea was that Muslims had gone grievously astray. They really needed to be re-educated. They needed to cut away all the accoutrements that had accrued to Islam, get back to the core, to the fundamentals. And then Islam could stand on its own again. It could do its own thing. But this was quite intellectual, and it wasn't so political. Abdu really didn't want to get involved in politics, unlike others there. Islam, he said, needed to be purified. Another group would be the neo-revivalist or the resurgent movements. They wanted to revive political Islam. They wanted to reconnect with the past in very real and tangible ways. And they thought hard and long about how to do this. During this period, these roots that had nourished them for so many centuries became crushed and bent and almost broken, okay? So heavy was the hand that was upon them. How do you reconnect? How do you bring resources and revitalization from this sort of stream again? And they felt that only a political Islam could really reconnect with the past. And they wanted to reestablish Islamic law, to go back to the way things were in the past. And they weren't against so much against modernity, but against secularism and Western culture. Okay? Among these were the moderates, who felt that this could be done in a slower pace, at a given time. It needed a lot of effort. But there were also the radicals. One of these was Sayyid Qutb, who came in the 50s, I think, the early 50s, to study in the United States. Now, I always tell my students, when these international students come, you never know who they're going to be, okay?
Exactly.
So you may treat them as though they're foreigners, as though they're of no account or whatever. But friends, that person might turn out to be the president of a country or a judge or who knows, you know? Well, Sayyid Qutb was one of those, and he was quite dark. If you've ever been to Egypt, you know that you can go all the way from very black to very white, and everything in between. Well, he was quite dark. Well, in the 50s, he came to the United States and had a very bad experience. The racism was very strong, and he was the victim of that on a number of occasions. People didn't treat him very well, and so he came here with high expectations, but in fact, it turned sour. And when he went back, he began to write, and to write of his account here. And pretty soon all he could remember was the decadence, okay, of the West, the things he didn't like. And you have to say it put the stunness right again. He must have seen something good there. But if he did, he really didn't write about it. And he became the ideologue for many of these on the right. He became almost a saint. And his books now, even today, if you go to the middle, you can find Sayyid Qutb's books all over the place. Okay? And he saw then the West as the new Jahiliyyah, the area of ignorance that Islam encountered in the early days. Ignorance that needs to be overcome. And he didn't see a slow process. He felt that rebellion and revolution was probably the only way. And of course, he paid for that dearly. But he became the ideologue for these on the right, the more radical.
What happened to him?
Well, I'll tell you in just a moment, okay? I sometimes liken this more radical right. I'm not talking about bin Laden yet, okay? I'm talking about the radical right. I sometimes liken them to Ezra and Nehemiah when the ancient Hebrews came out of their exile. What did they do? You remember? You have to get rid of the foreigners, particularly the women, right? Women are bad influence. They had to rebuild the walls, they rebuilt the temple, and they went back to the law of Moses, Namus Musa, right? And their voices become quite shrill, actually. Now, we sometimes lift these folks up as, you know, and thus says the Lord, right? Okay. Well, these voices of Sayyid Qutb on the more conservative right here sound very much like Ezra and Nehemiah. And they want to get back to rebuilding these structures of the past that were so meaningful then. Get back to Muhammad, get back to the Sharia, get back to this golden age, as they often called it, because they had gotten lost in the wilderness of modernity. Okay? Lost in the wilderness of modernity, caught up in world politics over which they had very little control and to which they felt, and before which they felt deep humiliation. Now, this side tended to have the upper hand for quite a while, even with Gamal Abdel Nasser, when he came to power in 52 and then again in 56, he actually used these conservatives, the Muslim Brotherhood and others, to gain control, to gain power. But once he was in power, then he turned against the Brotherhood and began to imprison them, persecute them. There was a lot of torture. A lot of them were killed and suffered immensely. Sayyid Qutb was among them. He was finally hung. He was seen as the great enemy, because many of these now began to see not just the West, but sort of the Western constructs in the Middle East as also decadent and as inimical to the will of the people, to the common good, as Bill Grace would talk about it. And that went on until 67. 67 was sort of a watershed. Now, again, some of you who are older, you remember that. From the Israeli side, it was a great victory, right? 5 days. You just wipe out the whole Air Force and the Army and, you know, you do whatever you want. From the Egyptian side, that was the Nakba, the catastrophe, the absolute catastrophe. And so this whole sort of secular wing really then came under incredible pressure. Why do you try the West? Why do you try to do what the West has to offer? Why do you take a secular government? Why do you adopt socialism? Look what it's gotten us. And when the chips are down, they said, the West will always abandon you. Okay? You try to be like them, but really, when the chips are down, they won't stand with you. They will stand against you. And so they said, why don't we give Islam a try? Why don't we go back, as it were, to our religious roots? Sadat came to power. We came there just when Sadat was coming to power. He released all of these, many of these Muslim brothers. And the literature began to flow back, and he called himself the Amir al-Mu'mineen, the Prince of Believers. he styled the Battle of 1973, you remember that? The Battle of Badr. The Battle of Badr is a historic battle in which 300 Muslims defeated 1,000 Meccans. Okay? Nasser had used something like land, sea, and sky as the battle cry. It was very, very secular. For Sadat, he used Allahu Akbar. God is greater. The old battle cry going way back to the time of Muhammad. So he began to play with these religious rites and to use them again as Nasser had done. And then the Shah of Iran was overthrown in 79, right? And from an Islamic point of view, that was an incredible victory. And it's very interesting, when the Shah had no place to go and he knocked on the doors of America, you remember he came here? We didn't want him, right? Though we had supported him, though we had built him up. When he came here, there was no space for him. So where did he go?
Panama?
He went to Panama? Was he welcome there? No. Where did he go finally?
France?
Egypt.
Egypt, yes, thank you. He came to Egypt, and that's where he was given by Sadat, unfortunately. He was given a palace. Now, many Egyptians said, of course he has to be welcome here. Although he's an enemy of Islam, get that? Although he's really seen as an enemy of Islam, he's welcome here. But don't treat him as though he's still an emperor, as though he's still king or Shah. Just give him a normal home. But somehow Sadat went, I guess, too far and gave him a palace. And he's buried there now, and his tomb is there. Then, of course, from 79 now, so it looked as though the religious element now was sort of coming into its own. There was incredible fervor, intensity, that in the 73 war, we were there, nobody believed the national radio, nobody believed Radio Israel, nobody believed even BBC, and it wasn't until the soldiers started coming home and told about crossing the Suez Canal, knocking out Israeli tanks, shooting out Israeli airplanes, that they believed it. Something great had happened. This Bar-Lev line, have any of you seen the Bar-Lev line? No? Well, I mean, it was meant to last forever and ever. I mean, it was really entrenched there, was bridged. And that was a great victory for the... And then Sadat, of course, instead of capitalizing on that and using all this sort of religious energy that had got him that victory, in a sense, turned on it and opened the door to the West. And then all the Western goods began to flow in. And then by 1981... You remember what happened to Sadat. He was killed by some of the very radicals that had supported him and fought with him in 73. Now, if we go over to the left side, we'll see that during that time, during the 80s, the West, especially after the fall of the Shah in Iran, became very worried about this fundamentalist Islam. In other words, the forces now working against this religious new fervor, this wave, was coming from the United States and the left. And I want to read you this quote from Graham Fuller. He was a Middle East specialist with the CIA. He appears, actually, from time to time on CNN and others. Maybe some of you have heard of his name. This is what he said in front of the Senate Intelligence Committee in 1991, talking about the 80s. Quote, There was a genuine visceral fear of Islam in Washington as a force that was utterly alien to American thinking. Think of it now. Islam as an alien, that was utterly alien to American thinking. And that really scared us. Senior people at the Pentagon and elsewhere were much more concerned about Islam than communism. It was an almost obsessive fear, leading to a mentality on our part that you should use any stick to beat a dog to stop the advance of Islamic fundamentalism. End of quote. Did you read that? Did you read that? No, okay. Did you know about it? I thought you knew about it. Who was the dog at that time? It was Iran, right? And then who was the stick that we were using? Helping to Iraq, okay? Helping, you know, to arm and to defeat and to stave off Iran. Because of oil, because of, you know, maybe a lot of reasons. But we were using Iraq. Now, think of it. At that same time during the 80s, while we were supporting Iraq to fight Iran, in the Afghanistan, what were we doing? We were recruiting the Islamic fighters, all right, to fight against the evil empire, the Soviet Union, because the Soviet Union had invaded Afghanistan in 79. So we even helped to train people like bin Laden. And we encouraged them to recruit other Arabs all the way from Algeria, Tunisia, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, wherever they would come from. Come and join us, and we will put you to work fighting the evil empire there. And so we trained them, and we helped arm them.
Isn't that an old standard great powers trick, though? I mean, the enemy of our enemy is our friend. They're always playing both sides against the middle, trying to create a space for them.
Oh, I think it's an old trick. Yeah. Right. Nothing new, but many people don't understand what was going on, you see. They don't realize what was happening, actually. And then we say, why do they hate us? Okay. But we don't ask the question, what were we doing to sort of cause the hatred? I think this is a much harder question to ask, and because it hits home then. Then after 89, when the Soviets were defeated, we left the Taliban, right? We just sort of, thank you, you served our purposes, we sort of left them. Or it wasn't the Taliban at the time, it was the Mujahideen, right? We called them fighters for God. And we just sort of abandoned them. And many of those fighters then actually returned to their countries. They returned to Algeria, they returned to Morocco, the Arabs now who had been recruited. When they got home, they discovered they were not welcome. They were seen to be far too radical. And so many, and bin Laden went back too. He went back to Saudi Arabia, and he was not welcome there. So many of them made their way back to Afghanistan, and that then became sort of the bed, the center of the Al-Qaeda, a movement. And then the Taliban got involved in that. Again, it's all part of just kind of a benign neglect, unfortunately. Now we're spending umpteen dollars, you know. If we had spent just a fraction of that in the 89, the early 90s, it would have been, could have been a very, very different thing. Well, hindsight is always 20/20. So that was happening on the Afghanistan side. Then in 1991, what happened in the Middle East then? Iraq had invaded Kuwait in August, I think, of 1990. But 1991, we had gotten a whole coalition, and we then broke the stick, yes? We broke the stick we had used to beat the dog. And so we had said no to this, and we had said no to this. Interesting. So I guess the question arises then with bin Laden, and I want to just focus on that a little bit. Out of this kind of confusion that was developing there, bin Laden, at some point, his hatred, his anger turned to hatred. That would be a wonderful study, I think, sometime for somebody to do. Bin Laden, who was our friend, our ally, whom we helped to train, and so on and so forth, at some point, he became angry, and then that anger spilled over into hatred. Where was that point? When did that happen? It's interesting when you read his some of the things that he's written, and I find that many Americans have hardly read anything of what he and others like him have written. This is not a war of ideas, of conversation. This is a war whereby you dehumanize, you demonize, and then you bomb. And you really aren't in conversation. But he said what really turned him off, what really angered him, maybe that was one of those turning points, was when the troops in the Saudi Arabia stayed after the Gulf War. And they became a military presence of, 67,000 strong. Now, was he right in that? Who can say, right? But it was sort of that act that really, I think, triggered that kind of jump from anger to... Now, many, I think, in the Muslim world, and we lived there about 26 years, I think share with bin Laden the grievances that he has lifted up, the Palestinian issue. Friends, wherever you go in the Muslim world, there's a deep sense that somehow a real evil is being perpetrated against the Palestinians. Whatever you may think of that, in the Muslim world, there's a deep sense of something has gone astray, and the Palestinians need to be listened to. They need to have a voice. They need to be heard. The second thing is, he wrote about, is the Iraqi embargo and the huge numbers of women and children, primarily, who have died as a result of this. Many people have documented this. The UN has documented that. But still, it goes on. This is a deep grievance, I think, that many in the Muslim world feel very strongly about. The third area would be the troops in Saudi Arabia and what that means. And then a fourth thing that he always lifts up is the U.S. Support of corrupt regimes. And the only desire of the West, as he says, is the oil. Okay? Well, it's oil, stupid, you know. and so we prop up all kinds of regimes because we want that oil to be protected for us. It becomes, one of our presidents said, our oil. Right? I have a quote, our oil, and as our national security is involved. Well, many in the Muslim world would feel deeply about these grievances, but I would say the vast majority would not agree at all with these tactics of what they have done. The killing of innocent people, the destruction of these towers and the Pentagon, that is not where they're at all. But the grievances behind them are very, very real. I think consequently, And you may, I'd like to get your comments on this. Bin Laden and his ilk, we don't know how many there are. Their hatred, I think, has intensified to the point where they are unable to see any good in the West. Okay? Not maybe unlike, say, Qutb Efduwat, you know. And you say, but there's got to be some good that you can see. I think their hatred has actually kind of blinded them to that. But worse than that, maybe even, is that they have romanticized the past. Okay? They are so eager to somehow restore what was that they look at this through rose-tinted glasses and have totally lost a critical perspective. And I want to read just a quote from Wilfred Cantwell Smith, if you'll allow me, what he says about this possibility. He writes, "This process of glorifying the past, romanticizing the past, turns disruptive when the grip of the need to defend is tightened to the point where this delight in greatness, this compensatory self-satisfaction becomes the compulsive cause rather than the honest result of historical reconstruction. Historiography is then designed almost explicitly to nourish and to support one's predilections. It seeks not to analyze or to understand the past, but to glorify it, that is, to glorify oneself. The purpose is not investigation, but aggrandizement. Not intellectual accuracy, but emotional satisfaction." I don't think that's just in, you know, with the Arabs. I think we all suffer from some of that. But do you see what he's saying? When you romanticize the past and you try to sort of hold that up as the image, as the ideal, the goal, seems to me that you've lost a vision. You really have no vision for the future. There's no hope. As we talked about this morning, there's no hope in that kind of in that pathway. Well, let me just, I didn't mean to go on this way, but sometimes you just kind of have to share your heart, having lived there for so many years. But let's get some feedback on this, because I know that all of you probably have deep feelings about this. And we didn't say anything about Israel yet, right? We could spend the whole, you know, course on that, etc. But usually Israel plays into this picture, and often in very detrimental ways to the Arab. May I make one final comment? This picture, remember, I said, the roots of Muslim wage. What Bernard Lewis did in that article, when it came out, I had to respond to it. Because he suggests, he says, that Muslim fundamentalists are at enmity with Western civilization. Okay? Muslim fundamentalists are the enemies of Western civilization. Huntington's article came out just about the same time. But he implies, and this, it seems to me, is the kind of dangerous thing that I want to highlight. He implies that the very fundamentals of Islam are at enmity with Western civilization. See? Implying again that Christianity has made peace with secularism, with nationalism, with whatever we have here in the West. It's Islam that hasn't made peace with that, and therefore the fundamentals of Islam become at enmity. And I guess I want to say, well, if that's the case, then Christianity also is. I mean, is. But let's just look at that once, you see. What does that say about our Christianity, about the way we have made peace with the way things are today? See? And then Islam sort of challenges us maybe in that way. Yeah?
I'm wondering about the Arabs feeling about the Palestinians, and that, you know, the government supports the Palestinians, but do they welcome them into their own country? They send the money. Is Bin Laden just using the Palestinians? I mean, like we've used people. I mean, does he really care about them, or do they just further his purpose?
You can go back and forth on that. Many have said, well, if the other Arab countries would have welcomed all the Palestinians, the problem would have been solved. I don't know whether that's the case or not. I don't think it's quite that simple. And many have made their way into the Arab world, and many have made their way into this, you know, into our country as well, right? The Palestinians abroad tend to do very, very well. I don't think that's the issue so much as what they see as a tremendous injustice having been done to the Palestinian people.
In terms of the land.
Well, that's just part of it. But more than that, the way they've been treated, humiliated, et cetera, by so many, the West, as well as other Arab countries, yeah.
Now, back to your main thing there, there's folks who believe that Islam, not only fundamentalist Islam, but Islam in general, is alien to Western culture and to Western civilization.
Right.
How many Muslims are there in the world?
Well, probably 1.3 billion.
Yeah, do we want to alienate 1.3 billion people? and that would be a great threat to our security. I mean, we will have our oil cut off if we do that. So,
yeah. Right.
Harold, is it the fundamentalism that you described in Islam? Same similarity as fundamentals in Christians and in Jewish?
Oh, yeah.
Culture?
I have this wonderful book which was sent to me. Have some of you read it? The End of Days by Gershom Gorenberg. He's a Jewish writer. Any of you read it? It's a frightening book. I don't recommend it for bedtime reading. But he talks about how Jewish messianism, the very right wing, you know, the Gush Emunim, links up now with the Christian right on Armageddon and premillennialism, and these are beginning to coalesce now. And at the heart of it is this the Dome of the Rock, right? And the schemes that are being put how to get rid of this Dome of the Rock, because it's on exactly the site where the temple stood. And there are all kinds of plans. I suggest you read it, but carefully. There are all kinds of plans now how to make this happen. But the Dome of the Rock is the problem. It needs to be removed. And it absolutely links up with all of these and the fundamentalists among Muslims too.
But they're always going back, looking back.
They're always going back, trying to reconstruct this past, to resurrect this past, to resurrect the Davidic kingdom or whatever. Sure.
Have you seen that book by Karen Armstrong, who's the former Catholic nun? I think it's a similar book.
Yeah, it's very good.
I started to read it, but it got really heavy. You know, pretty complicated.
Yeah, right.
My question is, the hatred in the Middle East towards us, how much of that do you think is due to our lifestyle?
May I just make a comment? Having lived there for 26 years and lived through revolutions and wars, I want to say that I don't think in any way that the Arabs as such hate Americans. Okay. They have always said to me, in the midst of the wars, siyasi to siyasi, washab washab, politics to politics, and people to people. They disagree, and sometimes they are angry at and even hate our policies, but they really admire the American people. They really do. And many of them have said to me over the years, if you could just listen to their story, if you really knew what was going on, you see, you would understand, and you would think differently, sort of. They deeply believe this, that the American dream, the American freedom, the American, you know, all the things that we have here are really what they want. The idea that they are opposed to freedom and therefore are attacking us. This is just hard, you know, it's hard, I don't know where that's coming from. But there are those who do hate our policies, and now Bin Laden and his ilk actually do hate, I think, Americans. He has said in one of his fatwa, Americans are fair game wherever they are. It doesn't matter, men, women, children, wherever. So that's gone, you know, that's really gone radical. And you can see what happened. This is what they do. Yeah.
What, from your perspective, I mean, you know all sides of this question. What do you think we should be doing as a government and as a people?
Oh my goodness.
Well, clearly,
whoever's in power in this country is clearly not doing a very good job of anything, and it looks like we haven't been for a long time. What should we be doing, and how might we go about it?
May I just last two minutes refer to Martin Marty, our saint, you know? He wrote Pluralism and Civility. He said, let me just quote one sentence here. Since September 11, I have valued a line from theologian Reinhold Niebuhr, written exactly a half century ago as America entered the Cold War. And he quotes, "That was a paradise of domestic security suspended in a hell of international insecurity." End of quote. On that September morning, the cord of suspension was cut. We Americans were dropped into that sphere of global insecurity. Thus we have joined the human race. Wonderful. Just to recognize that many people have suffered this kind of onslaught in many, many different ways, and now we are part of that sort of sea of insecurity. We have joined the human race, as Marty puts it. And then he says, he makes this one, he said, "An argument is based on the answer, conversation on the question. In an argument, I know the answer and must defeat, convert, or expel you, or vice versa. In conversation, we know the question and must interact, respect, and learn from each other." You can say, "I've won an argument," but you can never say, "I won a conversation." And many can join in that conversation, right? You can always have more joining. And then you learn new perspectives. You learn to see things in a little different way. I think that's going to be the solution, finally. Step by step, little by little. I don't know that there's an instant solution at all. Although Sadat, in his visit to Israel, who would have dreamed that, right? Who would have dreamed that? There he was. Maybe something like that can happen, but ordinarily I think it has to be through conversation, asking the questions again, rather than arguing over the answers.
And but still, what can we do as individuals? I mean, these are words, and
right.
We need actions. Is it time for Christian soldiers to move onward and move to the front of the bus? Say, we're not going to sit in the back of the bus anymore. Do we march on something? What do we do? I mean, how do we bring about the change? Because right here, we have no power to bring about change. We don't know what to do. We're wandering around in the wilderness without a leader. And what we know that things are going on wrong. What can we do? Who will lead us? How will they convince us to follow them? Do we have to wait for a leader?
We're looking for your hands to pop up.
I really think a big part of it is the education.
Education.
It is seriously what's happening here, and if we can take that back into our communities,
none of us are experts like you, but we can find people in our communities who have who want to talk about this and keep the conversation going. And when people want to say, well, let's go bomb and let's kill, and to say, like Marty would say, let's talk about this rather than that kind of physical violent action. But I think it does start as simply as it sounds. It's with conversation, and then number two, education.
Right.
I think if all of us could go back to our school districts and say, what type of Mideast history is being done in our schools?
Yeah.
How much of Islam is being taught in our schools? To say nothing of Hinduism, when we talk about 1.3 billion, what's going to happen when India uprises
yeah.
about Hinduism?
Yeah.
It's going to be the same thing because we're being pushed out of India the same way. So we in America, I believe, really need to be educated and to talk, and to talk, and to talk. If a quarter of the money that was spent on bombs and planes could have been spent on educating.
Right. Well, yes, thank you. And we need to end, or we're past time. But when, if you want something concrete, when you go back to your congregations, look around for the closest mosque, okay, and invite them. Get in conversation with them so that Muslims begin to have names, they begin to have faces, and they begin to have stories, and you see how human they really are, okay? And how human we are, and how much we actually share in common. Search for those commonalities, and then against those commonalities, we can place our differences. Sometimes we focus only on the differences and we don't have any space left for the commonalities. I would say do it just the other way around. And please, if I could have one last... Some people see this as a recipe for Armageddon, right? I would say maybe this could be birth pangs. Okay? I'd like to end that way. That when you go home, look for signs of hope. Look for signs of new birth. Look for those little green, that little green grass that's growing. There are many of these. They often don't get the press. They don't get noticed. But they're going on. They need to be nurtured. We can look for death throes if we want to. And we'll usually find what we're looking for. If we begin to look for birth pangs, God is doing something new out of this whole cauldron, I think. And we just need to lift up those little signs of hope. Those efforts of possibility, those little lights, whatever you want to call them, and nurture them and nourish them, give them all the best that we can. Thank you.